This week on the Ocean Cruisers podcast, I'm having a chat with Pascal and Troy from the YouTube sailing channel Free Range Sailing and Free Range Homestead. They've been cruising around Australia on their Clansman 30, a sloop-rigged Australian monohull built in 1969. Troy spent a life on and in the water as a diver and a commercial mariner. Troy in 2014 and has since been spending time sailing, and in 2017 they became full-time liveaboard cruisers. Last year they performed an extensive refit on their boat. They did the rigging, the deck, the hardtop, and they did a full interior refit so they could complete the tour of Australia. They've become seasoned anglers and divers and are now settling some roots on land in a homestead they're developing. If you want to follow Pascal and Troy's journey and also check out their homestead, take a look at the YouTube channel. If you want to support the podcast, check out our Patreon page. Also have a look at our Instagram and Facebook where you can keep up to date on who we're talking to and what we're doing.
Pascal actually sailed before. Well, you got into sailing younger than I did, didn't you?
Well, I did some sailing at school. I never actually imagined I would live on a sailboat. That was sort of like not something I'd considered until I met Troy. So I'd mucked around on like little dinghies at school. But then I hadn't really gone sailing again since then, until I met Troy.
I think mucking around on little dinghies is underrated.
Yeah, it's fun for sure.
And it teaches you some good discipline. Yeah. I sort of knew I wanted to live on a boat. I wanted to live in an alternative fashion from a very young age, and a boat sort of struck me, and I knew that I was going to do it when I left high school. But I don't know, it might have been my Austrian blood. I had a bit of a sort of, if I'm going to do this, I need to do it correctly. So I sort of went into the commercial marine, and I didn't actually go sailing until quite a bit later. But okay. I went overseas and did a bit of delivery work and stuff like that. And then, of course, all of the stuff on Marul. There was only a few years where I did it before I met Pascal, and then we filmed a lot of it. So a lot of people have been along for the journey, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. I mean, at such a young age, what made you want to live an alternative lifestyle? Because it's, unless you inherit it from like your parents and their experience, it would be pretty strange to come to that conclusion on your own so young.
I don't know how old you are. Do you remember an old movie called The Emerald Forest?
I don't know that movie.
It's okay. So what happens is
I'm 37.
This little kid gets like dragged off to the Amazon rainforest with his engineer father for some sort of mining venture, and gets pinched by the local Indians and dragged off, and he's raised like in the jungle. Right. And I was like, that is awesome. And that was, I think that was before I was 8. So I don't know, maybe I was infected by that movie.
They wanted to get stolen by Indians and dragged up into a forest.
Yeah, I don't know, the poison arrow frogs and all the rest of it. But I've been fascinated by, you know, like I've always been sort of outdoors and mucking around with a dog and a slingshot in my back pocket and stuff like that for forever. So
yeah,
school was a real trial. Like I enjoyed primary school, but after that, it was no.
It's just, yeah,
I wanted to go and do other things. I wanted to go and have a look around, and I really wanted to be good at a broad range of things, so which is sort of weird in this world where everyone's sort of specialized. It's going against the grain a little bit.
Yeah, but it's great. I mean, to have a skill set where, you know, you can live outdoors and you can just survive by your own means, like that's actually so useful. Not because we're expecting Armageddon or anything, but it's just nice, you know what I mean, to be able to, well, do exactly what you've done now, which is, you know, just get a plot of land and, like, survive. It's admirable, and I think it's necessary as well. I was having a conversation with my sister, actually. My sister just came over for, like, the first time in 2 years. I haven't seen her in ages, and we were talking about, like, experiences from, like, wanting to travel, and I think it was actually British curriculum to read Lord of the Flies and study it, where, you know, the kids all end up on the island and they're fending for them. I mean, it turns out terribly, but the idea of, you know, going to a remote island and learning all these skills and stuff, like, that really interested me when I was a kid. I think that's probably one of the first things that wanted to get me into it.
I don't know. I think adaptability is a good life skill. I don't know if it'll make you rich, but it makes you happy.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, if you don't have one, at least you can have the other. So Pascal, in Australia, they like take school kids out in dinghies and teach them how to sail.
Yeah, it's one of those after school activities that you can sign up for. Yeah. That's like really it's cool. Run by yacht clubs, so yeah, you just pay an extra fee and then you can go after school and learn how to sail, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, that's really awesome, actually.
I mean, it
might happen in some of the coastal towns. The closest we got when we were younger was like whitewater rafting.
Like
canoeing in a pond, like where you, you just collect frogs and dissect them. That's kind of what you get into when you're like 13 and you've got a school trip. But that's really interesting. So for you, it was like you had sailing experience, but the idea of living on a boat never contemplated it at all.
Not at all. And I'll just say that it was really minimal sailing experience. Like I wasn't particularly good at sailing. I remember just capsizing a lot with my friend and just laughing. It was just like that was my early exposure to sailing.
And liverboard sailing, so little of it is about sailing.
Yeah, it's not really the same as racing around in a dinghy. Yeah.
It's fun. And,
particularly in remote Australia.
Was that, sorry?
Oh. No, it's just because you referenced the capsizing. Like whenever we go out sailing for the day or we just do a little regatta, we always enjoy just walking over to the yacht club and just watching the kids, you know, spin around in the dinghies. Just keep on capsizing and go around. They're so resilient. They don't mind it at all. Yeah, it looks like fun. Sorry, what were you saying there? I think you're talking about like liverboard sailing.
Yeah, it's different to dinghy racing.
You want to be able to sail fairly proficiently, but so little about liverboard sailing is about the actual sailing.
Yeah.
You know, anchoring proficiency, just dealing with adversity, you know, provisioning, coming up with alternative plans, coming up with accurate plans, you know, reading charts, reading weather. There's a lot of different things that come into it, and the sailing is 10% of your time. Yeah. And I think a lot of people, a lot of people think that they're going to get their sailboat and they're going to get all this freedom. But what you're actually doing is taking on a much more responsibility. But then all of the adventure and all of the good things that come to you, you can actually claim them 100% as your own. You haven't gone to a travel broker and they haven't set you up with someone to take you out or, you know, and all the rules and regulations that apply. You take 100% responsibility for it, and then that's really good. You know, you can take 100% of the pleasure that you got yourself there. So you don't actually get a lot of freedom as a liverboard sailor. It's incredible responsibility to the boat and anyone else that's on board, but it's very, very satisfying.
That's as a liverboard skipper in particular you're speaking as.
Yeah, well, most people are a skipper with a crew of one.
Yeah, mostly.
Most liverboards, unless they've got a family.
Or they have a big boat.
Yeah, so... Mm. It's one of the things that I've come across of people that are dreaming about sailing. They think that they're going to get a lot of freedom, but they're going to get a lot of satisfaction, but they're actually going to be taking on a lot of responsibility. And I think it's the recognition of that responsibility. You look back on all of what you've taken upon yourself, and it's very, very satisfying. You know, some of the places you find yourself, you just go, wow, this has been like a month of really hard graft to get here. And I've kept myself alive the whole time.
Mm. Yep.
Yeah, you know, that is like such a good way to put it as well. Just reference like the amount of sailing that's actually involved. Yeah, it's pretty minimal compared to like the planning that is involved. You know, to get food, to make sure that you're not going to get knocked about when you sleep at an anchor and stuff like that. The type of satisfaction. Yeah, I'd agree. You know, I think like, from the freedom perspective, like for me, it's not like you have ultimate freedom, because I don't think you really can in this world anymore, unless you go to like some remote island in the Pacific or something. But even then, maybe not. But
you're still a slave to the tides, aren't you? You're still have to watch the weather. I I didn't really, I've kept the habit of wearing a watch, but I didn't really need a watch unless I was sailing, because I needed to know what the tides were doing. You are actually beholden to all of these things sort of govern your life.
But I would say that you're free in a respect that you don't have to rely on any other humans. Like, you can make your own like journey, so you don't rely on anyone to get. When we sailed from Tasmania on the other side of the country back home to Perth, there was no one that could stop us, kind of thing. We weren't relying on any roads or fuel or anything. Like, we just went under sail, if you know what I mean. Like, it's not.
There could have been people that could stop you.
Yeah, potentially, like authorities, I guess. But like, it's not like you're beholden to like a road or
no.
Anything like that. Services or things like that. You're very independent. So it's sort of freedom, but it's sort of not freedom.
And also when you pay your money, you take the ride. So you head into a weather system and you're 3 days from any nearest land, you're there now. Yeah. And it doesn't really matter. Like, you can't leave the boundaries of that boat.
Yeah.
And you find yourself in the situation you put yourself in, and there's no, I might just call it quits and go home, because you're home, and your home might be itching up and down and stuff. And it might not be great at the time, but the next day or a couple of days later, you look back on it and you've seen. There's a lot of people that are getting around. They don't know their limits. They think they might. They might imagine in their head what their limits could be, or maybe they think their abilities are limitless. I don't know. But when you've actually got right up to the edge of your experience and your abilities, it's very satisfying to know where those limits are.
Yeah, definitely. What process did you guys go through to get to that point where you really understand, you know, like the competency of your vessel and the competency of your own skills? Because you do come across, maybe you're great at acting, I don't know, but you come across like incredibly competent, well-rehearsed mariners. Is that just through being on the water so much, or like, have you specifically put yourself through a certain type of training on your own boat to get to that point?
No, I don't think so. I've had 25 years at sea, and there's been some pretty bad judgment that's led to some steep learning curves. So I've been able to fall back on that.
Yeah. I suppose that we didn't start filming when Troy was fresh on the water. I mean, I wasn't even around then. So
yeah,
went on a sailboat.
We've had a few YouTube comments where people are like, "Ooh, I wouldn't do that." But they just weren't around at midnight when I've jumped into like 3-meter waves to try and recover a dinghy when I was a commercial fisherman, you know, or things where I've also had very, very good people in the past where everything was going bad. They kept their head. We made a plan. We got out of trouble, and all of those things you can fall back on. So all of those people, you're sort of standing on their shoulders. And Pascal and I sort of, as you sail, you know those limits, and you know that maybe you can push it a little bit further, but you don't necessarily want to push it right to the limit all the time. So we, like I said, we actually know our limits pretty well. And through experience, we knew the limits of our boat. I say new because it's sold now. So it's good, because people might get into trouble because they've never tested their boundaries. But I think when we were living all the places we went to through remote Australia and sailing, we fairly regularly tested our comfort zone, and we were able to push it a little bit sometimes. And sometimes when you know you're pushing your comfort zone a little bit too far, it can last for a day on a sailing boat.
There's times when we were trying to get out of like escape a weather system, but we were going up creeks that were completely unsurveyed, so we were trying to like get, you know, there was moments there where you're like, it was a bit stressful.
Yeah, but I'm comfortable with that.
You're comfortable with it, but I'm not.
As a commercial fisherman, grounding didn't really worry me, where it might have worried Pascal a bit more. So.
Yeah.
The most worrying part was actually sailing out of Tasmania after a refitted boat, because the rigging was all new, and we immediately went into a big system in the Southern Ocean. So
yeah, that was stressful for you for 24 hours.
Yeah. And I know that there'll be people listening like, that's not the Southern Ocean. I'm just like, hang on, I'm Australian. The Australian Hydrographic Service calls it the Southern Ocean.
it's a weird thing. It's like the Indian Ocean or the Pacific. I don't know. But it's right underneath Australia, like between Australia and Antarctica. So yeah, Australians just call it the Southern Ocean.
You know, I was having a conversation with my wife. This was a few months ago because there's going through high school in the UK, we have always called the continent that Australia sits on Australasia. And I think that just goes back like to way back in the day. And I did like this survey online and it was talking like, and it asked the question, which continent does Australia sit on? And I was like, well, Australasia, obviously. I had no idea it was called Oceania. I've heard of Oceania, but I didn't know what it was. I thought it was just like a place somewhere.
I feel like in school Australia? We just called it Australia is the continent of Australia. I think Australians are just
some people Australia
a bit arrogant.
Australia is the smallest continent. So Oceania is a region that it sort of encompasses a lot of the Melanesian islands and stuff.
See,
like
Australia,
that.
Yeah. I thought Australia is a continent, but then doesn't it include Oceania? Oceania, like New Zealand and all those countries.
Yeah, but we're in it. We're in Oceania, but the continent is Australia.
Yeah.
In Australia.
It's not a settled debate, is it?
It's the largest island, but the smallest continent is what I was always sort of...
Yeah. I don't think it's a settled debate because, like, there's still some encyclopedias, like, refer to it as the continent of Australia, and then some are like, no, Australia is a country that's in Oceania. I think Australasia is a bit... predated. I think that is quite an old-fashioned way to refer to it.
Yeah,
it was just a funny one. I think it depends who you ask and like where their naval history comes from. I think that's probably got more to do with it. So like when you first got your cruising boat and you moved aboard, like Pascal, that would have been like probably like an eye-opening experience for you, I suppose, because you've done sailing but you've never lived aboard. What was it like in those first like few months adapted to a super small environment?
Yeah, it was. Well, the thing was, I met Troy and I knew he was doing this trip to the Kimberley. And I'd been there once before on a bigger boat, on a commercial boat, just working for 2 months up there. And it was just absolutely incredible. And so going with Troy to the Kimberley was just like such an, I knew that was something I really wanted to do. And then once we were there, the thing is with the Kimberley, it's kind of really different to cruising the rest of Australia. It's quite benign once you're there. So it's a lot of motor sailing and just sailing in light winds, up rivers and very wild and isolated. So and there's not really that experience of having uncomfortable anchorages or big storms or anything like that. So it was a really good 4 month induction just doing remote Australia. So that was a good way to like ease my way into it.
I don't think Pascal at the time appreciated what a 6 meter tide or a 10 meter tide.
No, probably not.
When you're anchoring that low tide in 2 meters with like all of your chain.
Yeah.
That was way over my head, the anchoring stuff.
Which is good.
Yeah. But so that was a different, more stress on you, but not an uncomfortable experience.
I was very happy.
Compared to when we left and sailed up the coast, I found that quite difficult at the beginning.
Yeah, sure.
Because it's uncomfortable and you feel a bit sick and anchorages aren't calm and
I think the WA coast is a challenging coast, so Pascal joined me in Darwin. We went across the Bonaparte Gulf, and the locals call it the Blown Apart Gulf. So it's either smooth and you're motoring or it's
and luckily we're on motoring for that trip.
We got into the Kimberleys fairly well, but then coming back up the WA coast, you got a nice taste of what it's the shipwreck coast.
Because I mean you've basically gone from like anchorage hopping into like heavy passage making type of sailing, so totally different.
Totally different. And we're on a mission when we left when we left Perth to start the circumnavigation. I mean, at the time, we didn't realize it was going to be a circumnavigation. We were just aiming to
get to Sydney. Yeah, I was going to ask that next.
Yeah. Yeah, we were aiming to get to Sydney. And then by the time we got to Sydney, we were like, oh, we want to go to Tasmania. And then once we were in Tasmania, we just thought we should go home.
Just keep making
just
it
keep
up.
On going round.
Yeah.
How, obviously, like, you guys did, like, a refit as well, but how long would you advise to actually make that journey? If you wanted to stop at all the nice places and visit the different islands and the reefs and stuff, would you recommend it as, like, a year trip or a two-year trip? No. What would you say?
I don't think you could do it in a year because there's certain thick parts that you have to do at certain times of the year. Like they're times, really not tenable, especially in the tropics. So
it's very hard to make a recommendation because I don't know what people's what their preferences are. Like everyone wants something different out of sailing. We met some people in the Kimberleys that they thought it was nice for the first few weeks, but then they got kind of sick of it because there was no cultural aspects beyond 10,000, 20,000, 40,000 year arc. They actually wanted to see people, you know, they much preferred cruising in Asia. I would be happy for months upon months of just like fishing in amongst crocodiles, you know, and big tuna bust ups at river mouths and things like that. So I'll happily spend an entire dry season,
freshwater holes,
just in like a very small region, just living very wild. And so for me, 5 years is what it takes to see Australia, whereas some people quite happy to see it in a year.
So people
ask us for recommendations all the time, and I'm really loath to sort of give it to them unless like we're having beers, chatting in a yacht club, and you can really get a feel for what they want. Like, and then the recommendations even then would only be sort of anchorages and stuff like that. On such a broad life experience, I don't think I would give advice. So
I think it might have even taken us 6 or 7 years, but because of COVID, we kind of wanted to get home to see our families because we were thinking of seeing Victoria and South Australia, but we had to almost skip them just to get home.
I was diving on the Great Barrier Reef for just under 20 years. I think I saw over 400 reefs and I still haven't seen it to my satisfaction. You know what I mean? So
yeah,
there's places we wanted to go back to. We just never made it there.
Yeah,
because you're always racing the seasons. If you end up going back, then you might be trapped somewhere for 6 months because it's cyclone season or you've got adverse winds. So yeah, you actually end up missing stuff cruising because you don't want to miss those windows.
Yeah, you sort of do have to, because we do have a cyclone season. They're going to have to compromise at some point.
Yeah,
unless they take years to do it.
Yeah,
which is fine.
Yeah, I definitely make it as slow as, but like my philosophy when it comes to, because we're starting next year, we've just like identified our boat now and we're getting a survey on it. And like when we're talking about how long is it going to take to do a circumnavigation, I'm like 15 to 20 years because you just want to see everything.
Right.
Australia is just such an amazing country. Like you can literally cruise around the whole country. It's an island and you've got so many different areas of biodiversity. It's not like the UK where the south is the same as the north and the west is the same as the east. It's like totally different like when you sail around. So an amazing place to circumnavigate, really, because you're getting a taste of so many different types of, you know, life and culture and everything. It just seems amazing.
Yeah, I think with the circumnavigation of the world would be especially hard to plan for because you might just stumble on a village somewhere at the bottom of Vanuatu and go, well, why don't we just stay here for as long as our visa allows us to? You might really hit it off with some people. And then another place you might find with no people and you go, this is just what I want in this my stage in life. So you just don't know. It was actually one of the strangest things about having a YouTube channel that people would like give unsolicited advice was just so wide of the mark because they didn't know who we were. You'd look at it and you'd
That's
go,
the internet.
Lots of people ask us for advice and we try never to give it unless we actually see them face to face. It's weird to get this unsolicited advice. It's really just crazy how far just unworkable it is. It's something quite
and
different.
Internet people are so special. We're selling like a bunch of our stuff at the moment. So, you know, you put a random thing on like Facebook Marketplace. Oh, I'm selling this because I'm moving. And you get people responding like, oh, this seems dodgy. Where are you moving to? I'm like, what? Just a refrigerator, man. You know what I mean? Like, mind your own business.
Yeah. Did you steal the fridge?
Yeah, it's crazy. Like, we've put a load of jewellery for sale because we don't want to, you know, keep it on a boat whilst we're cruising around. There's no point. It's just asking to be stolen. And then people are just like, well, why are you selling it? What type of boat is it that you're going around on? You know, can you not keep us? I'm like, oh, gosh, just move on. You know?
Yeah.
So strange. But, yeah, the unsolicited advice thing is definitely a good one. So you just said that you sold the boat.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we...
We actually haven't announced it to anyway.
Yeah.
People get it.
I guess, yeah.
A sneak preview on your podcast.
Some of your patrons know that.
Yeah.
Oh, we can put this online when you've already announced it. It's no worries.
No, it's fine.
It doesn't matter. So it's very hard to have like a cruise. The way a boat's set up like that, it's very hard to have it sitting in a marina while you're focusing at 110%. Like the first year on a block of land is incredibly intensive and there's not really time for the boat there. And boats just become, they're neglected like any other sort of living thing, you know?
Mm.
Yeah.
So they are, they're literally like the closest analog to a living thing that I can think of, you know, the sea is always trying to pull them apart and they really do need constant care. Mm. And constant use really to keep going. So
yeah.
Oh, I know marinas are full of boats and now they do fine, but a lot of people that their boats are really in good condition and the toilet works when they want to use it again. You know, they'll normally have someone looking after it full time.
Mm.
Anyone that owns a boat in the marina will just go, oh my God, he knows about my toilet issues.
Yeah. No, it is funny. I mean, you know, if you leave them for too long, you literally get organisms growing all over them and inside them and in the showers and stuff. So, yeah, you know, they do become alive.
Yeah.
Are we, like last year, I just sold the cruising boat that we had. It was like a 34-foot nice British cruising boat. We just sold that. So I left it from November to like February because I did a sail across the Atlantic to the Caribbean and I just had no time because we're renovating the house and stuff. And when I got back, oh my gosh, it was lethal. Like they say that black mold can kill you. Like it was a death site. It was incredible. It was 2 days of going around with like baby wipes. So yeah, they need constant care and attention, much like an animal. Yeah. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah, a liveaboard cruising boat needs to be lived aboard.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that is absolutely true. So you did a pretty extensive refit on that boat. I mean, you basically made it a new boat and it was gorgeous. Like you did such a good job. Like the hard top as well. Like wow, you really did a good job on it. Did you intend to sail it for longer after? But it was amazing work.
We didn't show it in the footage.
Yeah, but between the two of you, like you're so good at doing that, which is great because now you know you're doing it on a property as well. So you'll probably make an amazing space to live there as well. Did you intend to do all that and then sell the boat? I mean, I don't know timelines because I don't know how those timelines are synced up. But was it like a year afterwards or something like that?
I think it was.
We didn't know exactly what the timeline was, but we knew that we weren't going to keep hold of the boat for years and years and years afterwards.
Okay.
But so that boat was sailed in a pretty crappy state for a fair while, and she gave us a fair bit of adventure and good times and everything else like that. And then we had the when COVID hit and everyone was sort of freaking out, we were just like, we don't want a part of that. So we found a nice little village in Tasmania and we wore a mask, but that was only because we were sanding, you know. And so we were able to have a very like positive experience where we learned a lot and did all those things. But Marul's a 50-year-old boat and I don't know, you've got people making a big deal about, oh, we're doing this for the planet by buying this brand new boat that's so energy efficient and everything else like that. From our point of view, the best thing we could do is stop that thing from going into landfill. So we just
Oh, yeah.
Put a little bit of our time and effort into just making sure that that boat will go another 20 to 30 years.
Yeah.
So people don't really get it. They're like, I can't believe you put that work in. But, like, work is – it's so much better than platitudes and all the rest of it. And we never really make a big deal of it on YouTube, but that's pretty much why we – it's a sort of a it's a sort of a lasting testament to what we believe. We wanted that thing to last, and we didn't want it to go in the bin.
Mm. You know?
In fact, we pulled quite a few things out of the bin to get that boat up and running. So.
Yeah.
No, you know, that's such a good point you just made. We're doing a group talk show type of thing for sailing. We're working on it right now. There's a couple of YouTube channels involved. One of the talking points, one of the discussions we had was about this new concept of like eco-sustainable boats that are, you know, very plastic and diesel dependent in their production and all that type of stuff. And it's like the most sustainable thing you can do is get something that was made a long time ago and just keep it in good order so it isn't a waste.
I've been told all my life that the problem with the ocean is plastic in it because it lasts forever. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Why keep creating more plastic boats?
Yeah. We can make this thing last forever with just some work.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we'll see. It might not.
The better boats as well, you know, I mean, you've got sacrifices. Obviously, modern boats are more spacious, but for what you needed, which was a strong seaworthy boat, there's no way you could buy a boat like that now when it costs less than $500,000. You know, to have like such a stable, ride when you're out on the ocean,
they
just don't.
Oh, you mean like solid anymore. Glass like that? They just don't build layout boats like that.
The way they sail, you know, like the motion when they move through water, you just don't get it anymore. I saw a TV commercial like last year, I think, and it was a TV commercial for Levi, the jeans. And obviously denim is like one of the most durable materials you can get for clothes, probably other than leather, I think, perhaps. We have to like kill animals to make leather, so it's a bit, maybe they didn't want to talk about that. Their pitch was Levi is the most sustainable clothes brand in history. And it was like, because our jeans last for so long, and it's true. Like, you get miners or coal workers that literally got their denims, like, in the 1970s. It's still okay. Do you know what I mean? So it's like, sometimes the best thing for the environment is not to get something new and fancy and has got a green label and the government say this is nice. It's just to get something that's really old but still works.
That's very much your
wow. Yeah, we try and stay away from the preachiness, but just hopefully, like, what we do is that's the only sort of our only message that we try and pass on is just if people just pick up that as just as we do, not as we say sort of stuff. That sort of led us onto the land as well. So we'll do a little bit of, you know, it's like same thing, low impact and whatever. Recently I was dropping a few trees and people were like, oh my God, you should be doing this, that and the other. And again, you know, it's like, all right, I'll take the Greta Thunberg challenge. I just spent, you know, like the last 10 years using 200 litres of hydrocarbons every year. Like dropping that tree was not a crime against the environment. You know, it was the wrong tree in the wrong spot.
Yeah.
So, I always find it funny when people are, you know, they're sat on the phone tweeting about the environment and I'm like, well, where did that phone get made and how was it transported to your pocket? You know, it's like... It's not that great, you know. So, yeah, good point. Yeah. Well, I mean, is there any plan to do more sailing? Like, have you, obviously in the distant future, because you've got your projects that you're doing now on land, is it something that you want to go back to in the future, maybe on a different type of boat or see a different part of the world by boat?
I'm not sure that we're willing to leave the ocean. At the moment, we can't really say because...
We're so focused on what we're doing now.
Yeah, if you had told me when I bought that boat, which was not that long ago, it's less than a decade, that you'll do this, you'll have a YouTube channel, and then you'll completely give it all away and go and start working on a block of land near your mum, I'd be like, what the hell are you smoking?
Like, hell no. Yeah. No chance. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's possible. So, and we were talking about it before. So now we know how to run a boat now.
Mm.
That's something that we know that we can competently handle. But we'd like to be able to handle this at the moment. I think things are also a little bit uncertain for a lot of people. And so I think we'd probably be able to pass on some lessons, don't you think, that may be able to help people out? Because that's all we were trying to do with free range sailing as well.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, look at us having adventures. It's like, we did this and we found that this works. Try it out.
Mm.
We might try that again. So it's going to be a couple of years. So if anyone's sort of like hanging out for us to go sailing again in the next like 18 months, that's
not going to happen.
Yeah, no, that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Hopefully we're going to have piglets by then, you know, but maybe not.
Yeah.
Sailing,
yeah. Yeah, that's nice. So how did, so obviously you've got like a plot of land now. Can you just explain, because I know I've watched your videos for ages. I've just found them like so pure and natural. Like I've just really enjoyed watching you guys.
No, you're the one, eh?
Yeah, it might be me. I haven't left any random advice. Don't worry, I'm not one of those people telling you how to sail. No, I'm not one of them. I'm not really a commenter. So how did it go with the lands that you've got and you're developing now? Is there an arrangement with the ownership, or what was the situation? I remember you explained it, but I didn't quite understand it.
Okay, so we might have to probably have to do a video explaining it better, but because that comes up a lot in questions, in comments.
Oh, okay, all right.
Which is cool that you brought it up. So we met a couple in just north when we were sailing north, and they are our patrons, so they support us on Patreon. And we kind of mentioned to them that we were thinking about moving onto the land after we'd had one last hurrah on Marul and had a sail with her for the year. And then they got back to us later on telling us that they had this block of land, but they didn't want to sell it, and it was really run down. And maybe on the off chance we'd like to caretake it for them. So basically fix up some of the problems, just make the land, restore the land a bit, fix up things, and just be living on there so it doesn't get more and more run down. So we basically do that. And instead of paying money to rent, we'd do that, like that work, sweat equity, in exchange for staying here. And they've sort of given us free rein on what we can do, which is really great.
It was good.
Yeah.
It's another reason why we thought we might film that, because that's another maybe people overlooking the possibility of caretaking as a means of access to land.
Mm.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of people that just generational wealth hasn't been handed down. There's a lot of people that are fairly well that don't have money.
Yeah,
there's no money to get into land. It's extremely expensive.
It's really expensive in Australia to buy rural land.
Yeah, and there are actually ways. Caretaking is just one. There are actually ways to get a hold of a block of land to try a few things, and it need not be that expensive. So we might try and explore that in the future and help people. You know,
like potentially adjusting land could work. So you could be renting like a smaller house somewhere and then adjust land off someone's, because a lot of landholders in Australia, they acquired the land quite early, or it's been passed down generationally between farming families, and a lot of them, they can't manage all of the land, but they for whatever reason they can't sell off pockets of it. So it's a good option to adjust sections of other people's land and then try out what you want to try out farming wise, even if it's just running, you know, stuff just for you or for
There was definitely a flight to the city of a lot of families, younger people, and it's left an aging population on the land.
Yeah, farming
and
families.
And there's people where there's mutually beneficial arrangements that could be made. We'd like to explore that, and maybe we might be able to help people out.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds fantastic. Like that. And especially because, like, with younger people now, the opportunity to, I mean, I can't remember. I was talking to last week. I was having a conversation with someone about it. I was, and because I was looking at my kid, and I was like, if if this generation that we're breeding now doesn't get help off their parents, they may never be able to afford a house. Like, home ownership might just be something of the past. Do you know what I mean? So, like, opportunities where you can have your own plot and do your own thing. I mean, if there's people that, you know, you can trade services with, you know, maybe you develop a little bit of land, you've got some chickens, you've got some pigs, whatever, and they can have some, you know, eggs and bacon every so often, you know, so, something right. like that. That would be a very cool thing to, you know, to demonstrate to the world on YouTube. That would be brilliant.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, it's not our situation, but there's also there's a gap between generations at the moment. You see that with the OK Boomer thing, or these millennials, you know, they can't do anything or whatever like that. And so there might be ways where people can actually, we're not so stodgy and, oh, well, we're not so useless. Mm. There might be a way of repairing some of the social fabric that's starting to tear apart in Western countries.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't want to get too deep on your podcast there, but I think people are looking around just going, what the hell is happening? No one's talking people aren't talking cross-generationally very well anymore.
No, yeah, it's true. Yeah, yeah. Well, it's just, I think the thing, like, over the last, I've noticed a difference massively because, like, the attitudes that people have towards their communities and their neighbour and their society in general, even from when I was younger to now, it's rapidly gone down the pan. Like, it's really, really lost it. You know, like when I was a teenager, there still was a strong sense of learn from your grandparents, respect your parents, and then apply those lessons to your own life and try and do something of meaning. Where it does seem now like it's about, you know, can you get famous and rich? And that's kind of it. You know? It is really, you know, like TikTok really hasn't provided any solutions for the world. I think it's just giving us a few extra problems. So, you know, the cross-generation conversation, like you were saying, it's definitely taken a hit, but it's so important because, you know, people from a couple of generations ago that didn't have internet, they have a completely different mindset of how to solve problems, how to deal with situations that a lot of young people would just not even know now. So, yeah, I mean, if what you're doing could help with that even, yeah, I mean, that would be a great service that you're providing for society, you know, would be a very good thing.
Well, yeah, we'll see how it goes. I think there's also we're starting to. I think we'll hit a crisis pretty soon as well. That there's mentorship is going out the window a little bit, and people might find that if they do a bit of a gisting and they're a little bit humble around their neighbours and they try that, they might actually find a bit of mentorship because workplaces now are so transient. But people just go, well, there's no employer loyalty, so there's no employee loyalty. You go into a job, why would you mentor the next lot? In the marine industry, it was really good because you had to mentor oncoming crew because sooner or later the ship was going to hit the fan, to put it bluntly, and you wanted your crew competent. Whereas in a lot of companies, a lot of workplaces, it doesn't really matter if everyone else is competent as long as you are. You know, it's that I've got mine sort of thing. Now, I think as people only have a workplace lifetime of maybe 5 years before they move on to chase something else, mentorship's gone out the window. Now, I think that's another thing that we're really it's going to bite us in the bum in another generation, I think. Maybe that's something else that is a hidden benefit of people doing that. So,
I think just
we're a long way from sailing now, aren't we? But
Yeah, we wanted to talk about like this next part of your journey as well, so it all feeds into it.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say that that was what was really already really nice about moving here is that we have neighbours and we've already made bonds with them and swapped information, which you kind of do when you're sailing, but they come and go, like they're not stable. So you will meet people cruising, but you might never see them again. Whereas with neighbours, they're there. So you can rely on them or ask them for advice. And that's been really great. That was one of the things we were really looking forward to about moving, particularly in a rural area, because it's, you know, it's a bit different to being in an urban area, meeting your neighbour and building a relationship with your neighbours. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, really it's cool. Nice. So these challenges
we valued our online community that we built around free range sailing. And what I was saying about commenters before, it's only a small slice. Like we really did value a lot of the people that viewed us and contributed in our comment section. We really appreciate them. But still they're virtual. It's a virtual community. We can't see and touch them or sit down on a chair and
borrow their tractor.
Stuff like
new
that.
New things that you need.
So we'd like a greedy, you know, we'd like a little bit of both. We'd like a virtual community, but we'd actually like real people that we can pass a glass of cider to, you know?
That's really good. And so with obviously the new project that you've got now, which is getting this land established, what's the grand plan with this? Like what did you go into this with the idea of it ultimately being?
Well, we still don't know. So at the moment, there's a lot to learn. You know, like as I said, you know, we're looking for that mentorship thing as well. So we've got some ideas based on permaculture we want to try out, and that's a great thing. So the people that have given us this land, you know, like because it's been neglected for so long, they're just like, well, just try what it can't get any worse, you know. So, I mean, we've got 2 years at the moment that we've agreed to. There's more to the agreement that I won't go into, but you know, at the moment, what's set is like the 2 years, and we can just try a bunch of different things.
Yeah, I guess it's we want to try
land regeneration.
Yeah, different land regeneration techniques, but we also don't want to commit ourselves too much because it's not actually our land. So. It's sort of a balancing act a bit.
Yeah, that like if we actually had this and we had the deed title, I think I'd have a tree nursery going right now.
But, yeah, we'd be thinking about planting trees for sure.
Yeah. But in keeping with that whole thing, what we were talking about of people might be able to adjust or borrow land or stuff like that, we're really trying to focus on what you can do to improve land quickly with portable infrastructure.
Yep.
And Joel Salatin was someone, and there's a whole movement based around his work, and people that are much even better than him but just don't get as much airtime, they're not as persuasive. There's a lot of people that are doing that where land regeneration, I think, will really come into the fore in the next 10 to 20 years, and a lot of it is mobile, low-cost, low impact infrastructure. And so we'd like to do that. So whatever we learn in the next 2 years means that everything can be picked up. Everything's inexpensive, low impact, mobile infrastructure.
Yeah.
So either we stay or we don't, but whatever capital investment we put can pretty much go with us.
Yeah.
But we want to leave the land better than we found it.
Yeah.
Well, hell, we already have. I took out those blue gums.
Yeah, we have stress.
So can you just explain with that? Like, so that is like transient mobile infrastructure for regenerating land that has been left, you know, derelict or just left to ruin for quite a while. Like, can you just explain what type of equipment, what type of stuff you'd use and like what the intention of those specific pieces of equipment are? And do you know what I mean? Just like a bit more on it, because that sounds really interesting.
Well, the main equipment actually is using the livestock. So that's kind of the key. So, which is very movable. You can transport your livestock around. And then around that is having like a means to contain that livestock and control them, get them to where you want to go. So you're intensively grazing them so they're not damaging the land. They're only there for disturbing the land for a small amount of time, because a little bit of disturbance is good for generating like growth in the soil and the equipment would be, I mean, the equipment to control the animals is normally electric. Well, what we've been using is electric fencing. Those two combined.
I think electric fence is pretty much, apart from like very well-trained packs of predators to circle them.
Yeah. No. It's the animals doing the work, and you're using the electric fence to get them to do what you want to do with the land.
Yeah, so it's confining animals to an area that you want impact for a predetermined amount of time. So at the moment we've got a 5 pigs on cells of land that are 50 meters by 20 meters, a quarter acre, and we'll move them every 10 days. And then they'll have 10 days of impact on the land and then 190 days of rest.
Mm.
And when I say rest, we'll try and reseed it with pea, vetch, a lot of legumes, a lot of nitrogen fixing things, ground cover and stuff like that. And when there's a lot of manure and stuff like that, we'll be putting like curbits, you know, pumpkins, cucumbers, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And hopefully there'll be some of it that just gets destroyed by bugs, but hopefully over the 9 acres, we'll get patches of just wild maintained vegetables. And as we go, we'll try and talk to more packing sheds and try and get more and more agricultural waste from producers here and run that through the pigs to save ourselves money, but also to take care of a waste problem.
Yeah.
So we want to try and address as many problems as we can without using money.
No, that's really good. So, I mean, effectively, you're using the animals in as part of the process to create your own food, like fertilizing the grounds and the soils and moving.
Yeah, the animals are the food. They clear the way for vegetable food, but they also consume wasted food that would go into landfill.
Yeah.
So we try and close as many loops as we can.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fantastic. That's fascinating. That's and are these like techniques that have been used like throughout the ages and they've just been abandoned a little bit?
I think
recently?
It's sort of making a revamp. It's an old-timey thing that you would plant out, like after your pigs have grazed, you would plant it out with pumpkins and those sorts of crops, and then you'd have food for the pumpkins the following year, food for the pigs the following year.
Well, so whatever plantings that we're going to put in, either we can consume them or by the time the pigs get back to it, they can deal with it. The biggest thing is we don't want to be we're in a production center, so it's not just willy-nilly. We don't want to become a disease vector for like our surrounding farms and stuff. It's like, oh, those idiots, they've just introduced a whole new fruit fly to the region. So all of that, again, you know, it's not just like some airy fairy thing. We are trying to do it responsibly. So it's subtle. We'll just measure what we're doing and try. A lot of people try these techniques and stuff like that, and it's let just nature go its path, and next minute there's a big outbreak of weevils or something like that. You know? We don't want that.
I was going to ask as well, like Australia is quite a regulatory country when it comes to, you know, the environment and
everything,
biodiversity. Everything and people, you know. There must be a lot of rules in place for people like you guys doing this now as to what you can plant at what time of year and what animals you keep and how you move them around. Would that be a correct assumption?
Yeah, I think, it's sort of...
We're not producing for market.
Right.
So it's a lot less.
Because we're just producing for ourselves.
So that's what it's about. Right.
Yeah. So you do come into difficulty. Yeah. I mean, I'm not read up enough about it, to be honest, to talk about it.
No, 9 acres is not enough really for livestock production. If we were market gardeners, it might be enough. That's another full-time job in and of itself. So at the moment, we're just trying to restore the pasture on this land and just see what it's more suitable for. So again, it's only for the first 2 years, but we're just trying to get that whole move onto degenerated land. Hopefully, what would be nice is a model where you can get your animals, you actually get paid to adjust them or get to adjust them for free rather than pay to adjust your animals. And then you might be able to responsibly take on more land that people just can't be bothered with or has issues with erosion or something like that. So we're really at the start of the journey.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things that maybe are pie in the sky. Maybe they're workable. We'll see.
Yeah, we don't know yet.
Yeah.
So we're trying to go into it sort of humbly. So if someone goes, that doesn't work, will take it on board, but they might not have thought through all the solutions, and people are coming up with new techniques all the time. And so we want to be open to that.
Yeah. No, it's great. You know, it just, it sounds like the type of thing that, like, you know, a good government would be very open to investing in. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you get couples or families who want to, you know, like, go to an area of the country where, you know, the, you know, certain parts of land haven't been taken care of, and there's an opportunity to produce, you know, like organic fruit and vegetables, or, you know, great quality meat or whatever, free range stuff. It just seems like something that a government should really actually invest in. Do you know what I mean? Like, rather than just rely on people like you who see a requirement and a need and a good challenge, you know, why is that type of stuff not, you know, pushed and encouraged? It sounds like it should be.
Yeah, I don't know if a government's going to be that proactive about something there's no demand for.
Yeah.
But it's good for the world.
It's hard for them to tax so it too.
Yeah, it's hard for them to tax it. There's a
yeah, can't make money off it.
Remember in Tasmania, we really got a bug for it, because Tasmania, there are a lot of small producers and a good food network going on, a real push for good quality food and good quality life as well. That's happening in WA as well, in small areas. I think there'll be more of a demand for it.
Soon.
As I'm pretty sure that people are, there's always been a push for more and more centralised control. You know, we need more of your ID, you need to use this amount of money, you can't have more than $10,000, blah, 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 blah. So more and more centralised control, but I really think that's starting to fracture, and people are starting to decentralise a bit more, which is pretty, I mean, it's crazy at the moment, but I think it's going to have a good result. I think that we might actually have people going back to more community values. Not everyone, but I think there'll be quite a groundswell of people that will want to know where their food are coming from and know that the animals are treated well and the land's cared for and stuff like that. Not necessarily the whole, like, oh, what's the carbon footprint of my food? They just want to know that the animals haven't been treated cruelly, you know, and there's, if they eat something, is it how many 100 different chemicals are on it or something like that, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
I think people would just get back to a much more simple requirement for their food, you know?
Yeah. You know, it's like we have a chef in the UK called Jamie Oliver, and he's probably like quite a controversial character, because he's done some things which you'd say are very good for like the environment and culture in general, but then he's done some other things which you'd say that's complete PR for your restaurants, you know what I mean? So it's a bit controversial. But he did a series probably going back about 15 years ago now, where he was really trying to get people onto like free-range chicken. From a moral perspective, it was just like, you know, chickens are actually really nice birds, and the way they're kept is quite horrible. You know, like the food that they're being pumped and they're being bred to not have wings and all this type of stuff, like it's pretty crap. And it was like, it's great. And everybody who we got involved in this morally was completely committed to it. But when you could get a normal chicken for £2 and the chicken that had had an incredible quality of life was like £6, it was like, people were like, okay, it's great, I love the idea, but I can't afford it. And it's just a shame that, I mean, I don't know if it's, you know, like the big producers have been able to squeeze the prices down so much that they're too cheap, or the free range stuff is too expensive. I don't know. But people do want to do it.
I just think people don't put enough for us, like, but pretty much all of our decisions, the way we live our life is really focused on having like the best quality food, because the best food you can eat is like your health for us anyway. Like, we have pretty good health because we're really focused on pretty much eating as much as we can, controlling as much as we can what we eat, which is what one of the main focus on the boat. Like, Troy and I just love seafood, and the only way you're going to get good seafood is if you get it yourself fishing on a boat. Yeah. And that was the sort of kicker for us, because in Tasmania we could actually get produce direct from farmers. Pretty much like almost everything we ate in Tasmania was direct from producers. And we were just like, we need to do this. We need to live this way. If we're not going to be on a boat, this is the best way to live, you know, knowing where your food comes from. And I just don't think people put enough value on food. Like,
And water.
And water. Yeah, good quality water. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, you can see a 2-pound chicken, but it's not actually going to give you like nutrients that a 6-pound chicken is going to give you. That's going to give you so much more nutrients. And also just from a moral perspective, it's consciously you're going to feel like a better person, you know, having eating something that's been treated right ethically or from an ethics perspective. Yeah, you can't put a price on that. Like,
I think from a health perspective, it's your choice, pay the farmer or pay a doctor.
Yeah,
that's a good way to go.
And also, like, you have to think about who you're supporting. Like, if you're buying that chicken, you're probably supporting a much smaller farm, more probably a family or, you know, not a mass-produced, big, shit, I don't know, commercially produced.
There's a lot of large-scale industries where, yeah, you're getting cheaper prices, but you're... What you're buying is what we've got when you look around us.
Mm.
All of the problems that people either feel or directly see, you know, this large scale industrial society that we sort of live in is upsetting a lot of people. Some people are fine with it, but some people feel that something's missing. They can't put their finger on it. And yeah, that's what it is. Yeah. It's that $2 chicken.
Yeah.
It's got no connection to anyone that you... Yeah, any like meaningful community.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, I was about to say it's the human element as well, isn't it? You know, it's like how many people have been involved in this that, you know, you may know or you may come across, as opposed to like how many shareholders or stockholders or something like that. You know, like my wife used to work for a Brazilian chicken company in Dubai, which why are they getting chicken from Brazil? It seems like a long way to get chicken. But they were putting the most chemicals into the chicken. And it showed when you actually tried to cook it, because you get a chicken that weighed like 2 kilos. By the time you've actually cooked that thing, it was literally like 700 grams. Like the majority of it just poured out as like salt water, saline solution, something. I don't know exactly what it was. But then I Googled it one time and had a look on YouTube, and it showed you these videos of what they were actually doing to these chickens. And they were just getting these small chickens, and they just had these huge injection machines. They were stabbing them. And then all of a sudden, the breast of the chicken just expanded to twice the size. I was like, well, that's not chicken. That's water.
You're buying water.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you're not actually buying a chicken. You're buying like a 700-gram chicken.
Water.
1.2 kilo. Exactly, yeah. Yeah, like some type of strange water. So it's like, yeah, it's not really worth it. But you are running a
sailing podcast, so people can understand that, like, sailing's not the most efficient way to get around, but the experience of what you get out of it, it doesn't make sense from an efficiency point of view.
No.
It makes sense only from a human point of view.
Yeah.
And so what we're doing is probably about the same.
Mm.
Yeah, it's the feeling that you get out of doing it. It's like you were saying, you know, you presume you have ultimate freedom. You don't. You've got independence, but it's those little moments that you get when you go through your journey. You know, you get to see sunset on the open ocean, and you get to see, you know, 20 times as many stars when you look up in the sky. It's the feelings that you get out of it that actually mean something, rather than you know, the end destination. Yeah,
all those intangibles are exactly why we're doing this as well. So it's very much a thing a sailor would do.
It's been nice actually. There's been a few people, well actually quite a few people, more than I expected, that have the similar mindset to us. They've either started homesteading and they're planning a sailing trip, or they've done the sailing and they're doing the homesteading. So there's been the farming thing. They have properties.
That follow us.
So
I think people that like being practical and like being able to do a broad range of things well, I think there's a fair bit of crossover.
Mm.
Being able to do things well, when you do have that desire, it leads to a lot of worthwhile things. Just trying to do things well. it's such a rare pursuit, you know.
Yeah, and it's just doing
not doing things for money, not making money. I mean, just doing things well, just slowing down and just step by step, and just looking at a finished product and going, "Oh, I did that all right."
Mm.
Yeah, No, it just, it means something. Do you know what I mean? It gives life a little bit more value. But yeah, I mean, yeah, it's like you said, a lot of people do it either, you know, they do one thing or the other first. We want to do what you're doing after we've sailed around. I think I have a bad back, so I'm like, once my back has finally given in and I can't sail anymore, then I might try and do the harder thing. You know, I don't know that I'd work out. But yeah, we definitely want to do it. You know, like just get a little plot of land. You know, grow some blueberries, avocados, have some chickens, that type of stuff. Just seems like the human thing to do. You know, it seems like the normal thing to do, really.
Get your fingernails dirty.
Well, listen, guys, thanks very much for, you know, talking a little bit about your sailing experience.
Yeah, drop by anytime and don't leave a comment. That's fine. It's good.
That's awesome.